Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis, and today we are going to talk about something that I think will be hopefully really useful to you in understanding the struggle that you're really going through right now, paying back your student loans. One of our trips for this COVID period of our life, we actually took a vacation, if you will, to Kansas City. So we live in St. Louis, so we drove over to Kansas City a couple months back. Cases were a lot lower then, just so y'all know. But we rented out a nice hotel and just kind of walked around the city just to see something a little different. And one of the things that they have in Kansas City is the National World War I Memorial and Museum. Now, this place is really, really nice. Like, anybody who's that likes history, I think, would absolutely love this museum. It had opened up like a couple months after we went there. And so we checked it out. And golly, I forgot how much I had forgot about World War I, because I read about it a lot when I was younger, but man, there is so much to know about World War I, and it usually gets glossed over because World War II is the big, intense, everyone and their father watches a bazillion World War II kind of movies like Saving Private Ryan, all those kind of things, right? And also, a lot of us grew up with grandparents that fought in World War II, whereas World War I, that was our great parents and our great great grandparents. So we didn't really have any of those living witnesses to history to talk to about it. So why is that related to your student loans at all? Don't worry, I promise I'll get there. Let me tell you about this book that I read after visiting this museum. So it kind of sparked my interest again in World War I. So I read this book called The Guns of August. So the reason it's called The Guns of August is because World War I started in August of 1914. And it really talks about the first year of the war and how it was just so different from anything that had come before. And I promise there's a connection here with student loans if you hang with me. The actual setting of the book for the very first chapter, it talks about this really interesting setting in 1910 at the funeral of Edward VII, King of England. There are basically nine kings there from all over the known world. So the setting of this funeral is basically just highlighting this old world order that existed, and it wasn't necessarily a good world order. It was imperialistic, it was nationalistic, all these different things that obviously led to war, but everyone thought the war was going to be really short, and everyone thought that the way you were going to win the war was with what the French call, I don't know how to say it really in French, but élan. Basically, you have to take the offensive, you have to charge, you have to fight with the bayonet. You need to ride out and meet the enemy with your cavalry and slash him down with your sabers. That was kind of the thought process for how to fight this war. They thought this, even though that at the time they had guns that could fling basically the equivalent of a car of exploding metal 10 miles. And yet they literally charged into battle in the first part of World War I with a bunch of cavalry and sabers and bayonets and old school tactics that were just weapons fought with the last war. And the last war was basically the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. So that was a war that was basically, they were fighting World War I initially with like Civil War era kind of technology against industrial level weapons. Everyone thought it was going to be a short war. No one thought that it was going to turn into a war of attrition. So people are overconfident. That's one thing that I learned in that book. And I certainly see that sometimes with my student loan consults. For example, people tend to think that they're going to make a lot more money than they actually end up making. So for example, a whole lot of dentists, for example, will say, I'm probably going to be making $300,000 or $400,000 one year. And I'm really glad you have that positivity, but the average dentist makes around $180,000 as a practice owner. That's kind of what the ADA numbers suggest. If you're living in New York, that might be lower. If you're living in Kansas, that might be significantly higher. But most people don't make that kind of money as a dentist. And a lot of people just tend to overestimate their willingness to sacrifice to pay back their student loan debt. That's another thing that I've really seen very commonly. There's a little town called Lake Wobegon. So people like to quote this, especially in the financial world. This is created by, I guess, a writer, Garrison Keillor. In Lake Wobegon, he has this statement where he describes Lake Wobegon as a place where, quote, all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. So the joke there is that obviously, by definition, you can only have so many people above average and below average, otherwise it's not an average. So yes, you could be in the top 1% income in your field, there's no doubt. You just need to work 50 hours a week, be in a place where your services are in short supply, and then you probably need to be a business owner. But the problem is a lot of people are unwilling to move and stay places where they're going to be a top income earner in the medical field. if you want to make a lot of money, you need to go somewhere like the middle of nowhere, Texas, in a small town with a lot of wealthy people disproportionate to the population. And you need to go somewhere where you're the only gastroenterologist in town. And if they want to go see somebody else, they're going to have to drive 2 hours, right? That's the kind of recipe for making a ton of money. Now, can you make a lot of money in Los Angeles? Yes. I mean, I've had people on our podcast that have talked about how they've had clients in Los Angeles making $1 million a year as like oral surgeons. And that's good. I mean, it's really challenging to make that kind of money in a place where there's lots of competition, right? But it is possible. It's just not easy. So if you think about other fields, right? Law, it's kind of the opposite of the medical field. Big desirable cities where the big paying jobs are, yet most people don't survive that long in the field in big law because it's bone crunching hard work. You're doing 80-100 hours a week, available at all times. Basically, when you have a deal on, that's the only thing that matters. You can't really do other things and get other things done. So you're doing all this work, and most people that I've run into, at least, don't desire a long-term lifestyle of being in big law. That's usually not what most people do big law to do. They eventually plan to get out and do something different. Certainly some people stay in big law and make a ton of money, and that's great. But I have had so many clients tell me something on the order of, well, I really only want to do big law for like 2 to 4 years to make a lot of money, get some savings, pay off my loans, and then I can go do whatever I want. And while that's a good approach, it's a good strategy, it seems to me that that's a really miserable time to sacrifice 4 years of your life when you're in your late 20s, which is one of the best times of your life from an activity level standpoint. So what about other fields? What about business? MBAs that go to top level MBA programs. You take out the $200K of debt for your MBA, and then maybe you go into investment banking. There's a show on HBO called Industry, and it shows people like hustling like crazy to get hired on by this London investment bank. In the show, this guy actually literally dies from a heart problem because he takes medications and different kinds of, I guess, stimulants and doesn't really sleep. And he's working on getting deals done 24/7. And he literally just dies in the bathroom. And my wife is no stranger to insane work schedules because she was a resident and worked her tail off in New York City residency. And they kind of really, I think, fairly kind of abused her, worked her to the bone, working like 100 hours a week, even though she probably wasn't supposed to. And they push you. And she's like, wow, even this looks really rough to me. And she's like, do people actually like do that? And I have some friends in that world. And yeah, they do, right? I mean, you have to have really hard work ethic to survive in that kind of a world. And you make a lot of money, but most people burn out because people aren't meant to work 100 hours a week or 120 hours a week and live at the office. A lot of the friends of mine that did it, they actually left with some health issues. Like they were overweight, they had sleep deprivation, they had bags under their eyes. I knew them in college. And then when I saw them after their investment banking stint, they didn't even look the same. I was like, oh my gosh. And now obviously some people do it and love it and survive and thrive in that kind of environment. And that's good. We need people like that, but it's not for everyone. So jobs have always been tough. And I imagine that it's probably very hard to wield a saber as a cavalryman with great skill. But guess what? It doesn't matter how good of a saber wielder you are when you're going up against a gun in World War I that throws the equivalent of an exploding car 10 miles. It doesn't matter. You could be the greatest saber wielder ever, and it wouldn't help. Even Legolas from Lord of the Rings would not stand a chance against an artillery barrage of a gazillion pounds of exploding munitions landing all around him. He would be toast. Why do we like to watch all these kind of like older sort of medieval style movies? It's kind of, it's like, wow, combat back then, it kind of like depended on who was the best sword wielder, the strongest person or the biggest, strongest guy, right? And now it doesn't matter at all. It's kind of, again, because of this new weaponry, and I promise it does have a connection to the student loan debt. Just again, stay with me. Now consider debt. What does your uncle say about student loan debt? Generally, he'll say something like this. Suck it up. You borrowed it. You have a moral obligation to pay it off. And it might not be your uncle. It could just be the boomer on Facebook, right? That makes the comment that you're like rolling your eyes at. But a lot of times you will hear this from extended family members, parents, maybe even aunts or uncles, cousins, whatever. And you're ashamed maybe to even say how much debt you have for fear that you might be judged. Because people will hear what kind of debt you have and they'll say, wow, that makes you pretty irresponsible, doesn't it? I graduated with only $10,000 of student loans. Why? What's wrong with you? Besides that being a really out of touch statement, it's just really shocking when you actually look at the numbers. Because if you look at the numbers, what the people in World War I went through with the weapons of the 1800s, that's exactly kind of what's going on right now with student loan debt today compared to student loan debt yesterday. So let's look at a specific example. Let's look at Washington State Dental School. Washington State Dental School for a resident now costs for tuition, equipment, and books, it's about $75,000 per year. Let's say that someone wants to judge you and says, why are you graduating dental school with so much debt? Well, let's say you live on $10,000 a year. I'm assuming that's a diet of Mountain Dew, ramen, and chips that you stole out of the garbage can. Okay, because $10,000 a year, you can't live on that. And so if you live on $10,000 a year, that's $85,000. So that's $340,000 over 4 years. If you include finance charges like accrued interest and origination fees, which are unavoidable, that's $425,000 post-graduation. And that's if you live on $10,000 a year. That's impossible. The dean of the NYU Dental School said a statement in an article for a public radio article. He said, there's some real horror stories with student living expenses here. When I read that, I immediately thought, go screw yourself. Excuse my French, but horror stories with student living expenses are not the reason people from your institution graduate with $600,000 of student loans. The reason people graduate from your institution owing $600,000 of student loans is because your required tuition is $85,000 a year, and the required educational costs that you charge directly are $100,000 a year. That's $400,000. And then if you add in the accrued interest and origination fees and the increased tuition that you know is coming, that's $500,000 minimum. So now, how much are you going to live in New York City by? How much would you ask that dean? How much does he live in New York City every month? How much does he spend? I'm imagining it's not $2,000 a month, but if he lived on $2,000 a month, then that would put him owing an additional $100,000 just from those living expenses alone, because you have to finance that as well. But actually, on top of that, it would be more like $120,000, $125,000 instead of $100,000 because of finance charges. So you would essentially graduate owing NYU. If you lived on $2,000 a month in New York City, which is near impossible, then you would have $625,000 of student loan debt. Please lecture us some more about real horror stories with student living expenses. You just, I can't say it on a family podcast. But clearly this person's out of touch, and so many people are out of touch when it comes to student loan debt. What's so fascinating is I want to arm you with some data that you can use the next time the proverbial uncle or boomer attacks you for your student loan debt. The Washington State Dental School example, I found some goldmine level data. I found an old journal article from the American Dental Association, the Journal of the American Dental Association, where it showed the resident level tuition for a first year dental student back in 1978. And guess what the cost was for Washington State Dental School in year one back in 1978? The report revealed that it was $1,029 a year. Tuition alone at Washington State's dental school now is $55,000. That's a 50 times increase, I guess actually 55 times increase in cost in right around 40 years. Here's a few more examples, and I'm just using this example because I found this data from the late 1970s for dentistry specifically. I feel pretty confident these numbers would be very, very similar regardless of what field you looked at. And in some fields, like physical therapy, you would look at this and say, well, not only did the tuition skyrocket, the requirements and years in school required to earn about the same level of money, inflation adjusted, also increased. So that's an even larger increase, because you're not just talking about going from 4 years to 4 years. You're talking about going from a two-year master's program to a longer DPT program. Here's some more examples from this list. University of Alabama's dental school was $1,200 a year back in 1978. It's $28,000 today. NYU, one of my favorite foils, right? NYU dental school was $7,200 a year. It is $85,000 a year today. Now, inflation means that a dollar in 1978, in fairness, is worth about $4 today. So that $1,000 of tuition for the Washington State's dental school, that would be like $4,000 a year today. So in other words, the Washington State Dental School's tuition went up 13 to 14 times more than the level of inflation growth. That is absurd. You can't talk about student loan debt in America without talking about the freaking institutions that screwed everyone over in the first place. How did this occur? Why do we have such exploding costs? One reason is extremely poor cost management. Put yourself in the seat of people who run universities. The fear of academic institutions everywhere is being shut down or shrinking because there's no profit incentive for leaders of these institutions. In other words, if you bring in $100 million of tuition revenue and you spend 80, you don't get to keep 20 and return a portion to shareholders, bonus programs, and stock buybacks and things like that. There's no profit incentive at all, which means that your goal is to make sure that whatever you're bringing in gets mostly all spent. And then furthermore, to give yourself an extra cushion, you better hope that there's ways that you're consistently increasing revenue predictably so that any budget holes that you have can be plugged with predictable increasing revenue. Now, in a world where you have to compete, that's really hard because other people would compete down the price and people might be able to go to another school for a cheaper cost and get the same value of education. But again, that's not really the incentive because you have the ability to increase your tuition at 5 or 6% a year because the federal policies allow that to happen with no regulation and unlimited borrowing. So you say, well, the way I can smooth out my budget is always just baking in a 5% increase in the rate of tuition. Politically, I know I can't go after undergraduate tuition because that's a little bit more sensitive. The state legislators care about that level of tuition a little bit more. So I'm going to focus on raising the level of graduate school tuition because that's where I can really pump out a huge profit and subsidize the rest of the university. So there's this field in economics called public choice. I almost went to grad school to study that because I thought it was really fascinating. It basically looks into the incentives of leaders and decision makers in not-for-profit and government jobs. And it maybe is one of the reasons I got pulled into student loans because I was so fascinated by just the economics of higher education and everything. Basically, economics says people respond to incentives. So what is the incentive in academia? It's to increase the size of your institution, the growth, and the prestige of your institution. Because ultimately, how do you get a university president job or a hospital president job? You need to take bigger and bigger jobs with increasing levels of growth in your institution and bigger type of programs that you're running. No one wants to see someone preside gracefully over a really bad situation where you're having to cut. That's not a sexy job, right? So the ultimate prestige in an academic institution is research, but not a lot of places have the funds for it, especially once you get outside the universities that have the huge endowments, which is really a minority of universities. So you have to get money to be able to spend money on research, so you have to get subsidies for that. And the most popular way to do that is to charge lots and lots of money to your graduate students so that you can then spend some of that money off and fund all sorts of other things. So you can fund research, you can fund administrative roles, you can fund building plans. And one college leader even told me off the record on the condition I never use his name that that was accurate. Essentially that his institution when he was there raised tuition an enormous level and took basically all of the increase and put almost none of it into teaching and put all of it into increased research so that they could try to move up in the rankings, which would then go and get them better students, which they get them more money for spending on research, et cetera, et cetera. You can also see this in medical schools and hospital systems. There's plenty of space. In the time I've been here in St. Louis, the hospital systems I've noticed have been on a building bonanza. They have maybe, I don't know, increased the size of the hospitals in this area, maybe like 20 to 40%. I mean, it's just enormous, the amount of new buildings going up everywhere. One thing that's so puzzling from somebody who studied economics is that a lot of these buildings, not obviously the ICUs, obviously with COVID and the need for, from what I understand, the need for staffing is the most important critical shortage versus necessarily just the need for beds. But you could say that, oh, well, thank goodness they had the extra space for COVID. I don't know. I'm not qualified to have that discussion. But I'm just saying, in normal times, what do you notice about a lot of hospital campuses? They're largely empty after 5 p.m. Not for labor and delivery, not for surgical things. Obviously, they have to have 24/7 staffing for emergency rooms and such. But just for your discretionary kind of services, right? Your dermatology appointments, your screenings for your colonoscopies, those kind of things. A lot of times they don't take advantage of the buildings that they have. And so because these institutions have the incentive to spend all the money they make and not to look like they have a profit, you just have bigger and bigger expenses every single year. If you build a bunch of buildings, if you put your name on a new cancer center, right? That's how you get the bigger job, and that's how you get the raises, and that's how you move on to the next big thing. So basically, that's the problem with our higher education system, is we have runaway costs and no one's being held accountable. Did you know that one of the reasons that University of Washington Dental School has the worst explosion in tuition, maybe in the nation, for graduate school, is I heard there through the rumor mill that there was a dean that made a bunch of bad decisions and opened a lot of new facilities and programs, lost millions of dollars, and then begged for a bailout and essentially sent a letter to a state legislator saying that if the cause of this gets out, we're all going to be very embarrassed. Then the letter got leaked. And so they basically raised tuition at the fastest rate in the country to make up for a university leader's stupidity from a financial perspective. Yet there's no accountability, and the students are the ones expected to make up for this person's stupidity. Now, that's an extreme example, but there's all kinds of things going on right now in higher education. It's an extremely wasteful place, and nothing's going to stop that wastefulness until there's reform of the system, which really gets at the root cause of why does it cost 50 times more money to go to dental school in Washington State than it did back in 1978. It's not because of public support for education. It's not. People will say it is. Maybe that accounts for some of it. But because the state legislator slashed the support for their dental school, that doesn't mean that that's what translates into a 50x thing. That's an excuse, okay? And people in higher education love giving lip service and excuses for things that they did, right? What do you do when you talk to somebody who committed the crime, right? They have an excuse, right? So it's the same thing in higher education. It's not my fault. It's someone else's fault. Blame the state legislator. Don't blame me, right? So anyways, sorry for the soapbox, but the title of the show, Don't Fight Debt with Weapons from the Last War. So essentially, we have a totally new system. I hope that the first 20 or 25 minutes of the show, you've realized, obviously, it's such a different world that we're living in these days. And so the uncle that has $1,200 of debt from dental school per year, so he has $10,000 of dental school debt that he graduated with. And he graduated in 1982 with $10,000 of dental school debt. And today, that's 38 years later. Okay, so this guy was 26 when he graduated. So let's just say he's mid-60s now, okay, getting ready to retire. And he's like, why aren't you paying it off? I paid it off so easily. And it's the same exact problem with the generals of World War I. All of them had been 20-something-year-old commanders in the War of 1870 between Germany and France, and they were fighting with those mindsets. And they were like, oh, I charged the enemy with a bayonet and worked great. Our cavalry charged at their infantry with sabers and it was awesome. You should do it too, millions of people that we conscripted into service. And they were like, dude, there's barbed wire, machine guns, and giant artillery that can destroy like 50 people at once. I don't think we could. I don't think we should do that. And the generals are like, no, go anyway, do it anyway. And that's the problem with higher education. Older generations are completely out of touch with the problem that exists now. But the problem is not student loans. The problem is the vicious system that got us here. And so one thing, there is student debt cancellation. I really hope that they just don't focus on that only, because again, it's kind of like a giant bailout for the institutions that screwed up everything in the first place. The reason why we need to talk about student debt cancellation is not because student debt is some sort of magical problem that we can just wipe away with the stroke of a pen. Like, even if we were to do that, maybe it is a magical problem you could wipe away with the stroke of a pen. I don't know. But even if you could do that, unless you fix these wasteful, ridiculous, predatory, nonprofit universities, because there are predatory for-profits, maybe they're just more obviously predatory, but don't kid yourself. Your typical not-for-profit graduate school is extremely predatory from a pricing perspective, because they have an inelastic demand for their good, and they have a lot more people applying than seats, and so they think, well, why not? Let's just charge a ton of money. The reason why they're able to do that is because there's no private sector enforced discipline on how much you're able to charge and still get a loan underwritten for, and so the government gives an unlimited amount of money to finance someone's education. Well, there's not a problem with that if you have regulation. If you have a regulation which caps the amount you can borrow, which limits how universities are allowed to charge people, how much they're allowed to raise their tuition by, then at least you have a consistent system. But right now, it's kind of like you've got all the rocket fuel put into the engine with no limitation on where they can take it, right? So they're going to take it wherever they want, which is to benefit their institution instead of benefit students. The thing is, going back to that World War I analogy, you want to tackle your debt head on with weapons of the last war of, you know, live below your means, pay your debt off, just suck it up and work hard, pick up extra shifts and get some more money and, you know, pay your highest interest loan first and refinance to a 20-year term and keep your payments as low as possible. And then you can, you know, have money for other things. That could be possible. And let me tell you, if you have a situation where you should pay your debt off, go for it. That's not necessarily like charging a machine gun less. Think about it like this. Think about an artillery barrage that clears out all the barbed wire. That's kind of like what happens when you refinance your student loans if you're trying to pay your debt off, right? Is we get you the best refinancing bonuses anywhere in the internet. If you haven't been to our site for that site in a while, studentloanplanner.com/refi/REFI, just studentloanplanner.com/refi, you'll find new bonuses that are bigger than anything you've seen before. When you apply for the lenders listed on that table, you're going to find the lowest rates to get out of debt much sooner. So you can pay down your debt. I don't want to say you can't. You can pay down your debt. You can pay your debt down rapidly too if you owe less than 1.5 times your income. If it's more than that, you still can, but is that the life you want? For example, will your spouse go along with you paying down debt, either your current or future spouse? A lot of people want to focus on paying down their debt, but they put off things like a family or kids or house buying and life goals. And just as an example, I had a great conversation with a financial planner friend of mine who's married to a physician. She has about $100,000 of student loan debt, and she's eligible for a high five-figure amount of loan forgiveness if she takes a job at her state's kind of public health service. Now, what's interesting is they're interested in having kids, but they're flexible on the timing. She's got the $100,000 of debt total, and she's been on the repay plan in residency for the past 4 years for subsidies, because their goal has been to pay everything off and keep the amount to the total amount modest. Because if you can get a mid to high five-figure amount tax-free, and that can be paid towards the debt, well, as long as you keep that debt down as much as possible with those interest subsidies, then you'll be able to easily get out of debt overall. Now, let's assume that this physician, she's about to become an attending. Okay, so you're in, you know, this, I think she's in her maybe early 30s, let's say. So you really want kids and you want to put off having kids for 2 years, specifically because this public health role doesn't have really good maternity leave. And so that would make it really challenging to have a kid and still kind of have a good lifestyle while doing this gig, right? So okay, so you want to put off having kids for 2 years to do this public health role because you're really concerned about your loans and you want to get them forgiven. She's already got 4 years towards the 10 needed for PSLF because she's been in residency at a not-for-profit. Now, instead of filing jointly with her husband, she could file separately for taxes and pay about $100 a month, in her case, on her loans, 100 to 100 to 200, let's say. She could pay that for an additional year because of them using 2019 tax returns for the next 2021 payments all the way basically until the end of 2021. They're going to be giving you the option to use old tax returns if the payment is lower, or new tax returns if the payment is lower that way. So they're going to give her optionality to pay essentially another year of almost nothing on her loans. So let's assume almost no payments. Now she's got 5 years of credit. Well, keep in mind that when she'll become an attending, she's going to have half of the year that she's making resident income and half of the year that she's making attending income when she becomes one, right? And so that income would probably show, since she's in this case a sort of a lower income specialty physician, so she would end up having maybe payments that are below the standard tenure plan of $1,000 a month on her loans. She'd maybe pay another year of around, let's say, 800, you know, 700, 800 or so, about 10 grand total. So we're 6 years into PSLF and we paid 10 grand. Okay. And then we've got 4 years left to go. Her husband told me that she would take a PSLF eligible job just anyway if she just went straight to becoming an attending. So your payment would get capped out at $1,000 a month as an attending. So you've got 4 years of payments, 1,000 times 12 is 12,000 times 4 is 48,000. 48,000 plus another 10 for the year of payments kind of in between attending and residency life. So that's a total of $60,000 of payments on $100,000 of loans. And if she does the state loan forgiveness program, let's say she'll get 70 of that 100,000 forgiven, the 30,000 would have to be paid back with principal and interest. So let's say that would amount to, I don't know, 35, 40,000, something along those lines. Let's just say 40,000 to make the math easy. She'll have to pay 40,000 if she does the public health job, or 60,000 if she does an efficient form of PSLF. In other words, the difference between taking the public health job and not taking the public health job is only $20,000. That is, for 2 years, $10,000 per year or $800 a month. That is absolutely nothing. Now, I'm going to be a little bit, I don't know if kind of TMI is the right word or something, but like, having kids is not easy. Conceiving children is not easy. It kind of takes longer than you might think it might take. Now, sure, there's, you know, that buddy you went to college with that sends you a text and he's like, after a month of trying, we did it. Or the first time we tried, happened. That's not what usually happens. Particularly when you're a little older, particularly when you and your spouse are in your early 30s, things can take a little bit longer. And if you delay having kids at that age, there's nothing wrong with that. You can certainly conceive no problem in a future date. You can do a lot of different things, but your time it takes to conceive a child might lengthen. And certainly if your goal is having a larger family, then the options of you having more kids might be less. So if you think about a magical shot that you could take, if you take the shot, it's going to decrease your fertility 20%, and they're going to give you $20,000 to take the shot. Would anybody take, maybe 20% is too high. Let's say that there's a shot that they'll give you, and they'll give you $20,000 and it'll decrease your fertility 10%. Would you take that shot? The answer, I think, almost universally is no. Yet people so often will work 100 hours a week working in big law, or they'll do a ridiculous amount of shift work in a place they don't want to live, thinking they have to do it to pay off their loans. Or they'll take a job at a federally qualifying health center in Alaska because they're so afraid of not getting any assistance to help knock their loan balance down. Or they think that they can't work part-time with $300,000 of student loan debt as a physical therapist. Or they think that there's no way that I can get married or have kids or buy a house or go on this dream vacation post-COVID or live a decent life or renovate my kitchen or whatever your goal, whatever your dream is. There's so much thought that goes into, I can't do this. I can't do XYZ because of my debt. Why is that? It's because of the mentality of fighting debt with weapons from the last war. $1,000 a year tuition is the last war. That was the time when the frontal assault with bayonets and charging with cavalry and sabers might have worked. The full-on head-forth charge. That can still work. Even in today's combat, there's situations where you can still charge and you can still do it, right? But you need air cover. You need artillery support. You need tech. Maybe you attack at night, right? And so to make some of these analogies to student loans, you need a really high income. You need an emergency fund. You need diversification on your income sources between spouses. So maybe one of you does medical, somebody does something a little different. You need being really confident you're not going to lose your job. And if you have those things, if you're working in the private sector, your debt to income ratio is better than 1.5 to 1, then you should pay back your loans. You should refinance. You should do the refinance ladder, which we talk about on this show. You should start with a 20-year maybe to get a low payment, pay down the loan maybe by about 30 to 50%, and then refinance it again to a 10-year, pick up another cash bonus along the way, pay it down even more, and then you can refinance it finally to a 5-year variable rate where your interest rate's below 2% and to just pay everything towards the loans and knock them out. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But you had the support of all those things that I mentioned, making a ton of money, having really low living expenses, maybe living like a resident, like I said, having an emergency fund, living in a lower cost of living area, not having a $1 million mortgage that you signed up for while you're also trying to pay down your student loans. So that's this mentality of fighting debt with the weapons of the old war. If you have $300,000 of student loans and you make $80,000 a year as a physical therapist, you could pay down your debt. You could. You'd also live in a cardboard box for 10 years. Is that going to be sustainable? Is that going to be worth not having kids? Is that going to be worth not buying a house or not going on vacation? Alternatively, you could focus on saving the maximum in retirement, trying to save $500 to $1,000 a month in your brokerage account, and you'll have a great retirement at age 60 with student loan forgiveness along the way. If you want to retire a lot sooner than that, then instead of saving $1,000 a month in your brokerage account, you might want to try to save $2,000 or $3,000 a month in your brokerage account. Before you tell me that's not possible, keep in mind that retirement savings are tax deductible, so it costs way less than you would expect. You're going to be able to save a significant amount of money in a brokerage account alone if you're single, because hopefully you'll have roommates. And if you don't, that's fine. Just know that that's going to mean you're going to have to work a little bit longer. You're going to have to work maybe until your early 60s. And then when you're married, you have even more money to throw into things like a brokerage account until you have kids, and maybe you dial that back. Maybe you pull back your brokerage account to only like $100 a month while you're paying for daycare and school expenses for kids. And then you ramp it back up when you're able to. What does student loan payback frontal assault look like in a world where it really hurts? Well, there's situations where I've had people refinance into a 7-year term and their payment's been $10,000 a month, and they have not been able to buy a house and not been able to buy a practice because their payment was too high. Luckily, this person was able to do something about it. They refinanced to a 20-year term to get their payment way low. And then once their payment was low, then they would get approved for a mortgage and a loan for buying a business for a practice, to become a practice owner, to get a big enough shovel to attack the debt with. If you have a kind of a small bucket, you're not going to be able to put out the fire, right? Let's think about like residents trying to live on half of their income and throw the other half at loans and residency. I mean, good, more power to you, but that's like kind of taking a little Nalgene and filling it with water and throwing it on a house fire. When you could try to just develop good habits, open the right investment accounts, have $100 a month contributed to all your Roth IRA and a non-Roth IRA and a brokerage account, maybe try to contribute a little bit to your 403b plan at work, even if you have to jump through some loopholes to get there, some obstacles to get there. And then when you become an attending, you take your fire truck and you unleash a torrent of water on the house fire and you put it out quickly. But again, you can't fight student debt that exists today at the levels that exist today without at least considering the new weapons out there. Remember, what are you optimizing for? Who are you optimizing for? Is it your uncle that thinks that you just have to pay back your loans and he's just going to be so disappointed in you if you don't pay it back? Or the random boomer on the internet who says, hey, you have a moral obligation to pay back your student loans. Oh, okay. Do you have a moral obligation to pay us back for all the Social Security money you're bilking the system out of that you didn't pay for, where your present value of your payments is like a fifth of what you're taking out, where the Medicare premiums that you paid were a fraction of the benefit you're getting out of it? No, they just want to complain. So who are you optimizing for? The answer is you should optimize for your family. Now, I'm not a fan of going for forgiveness. I mean, like, unless the math says you should, because nobody wants to have debt around for 20 years. It's not something you go out of your way to say, oh, heck yeah, I can't wait. No, I mean, like, obviously, if the math supports paying it back, that's why we do so much refinancing for people, because I do like paying debt back. Don't get me wrong. I like that approach. But the thing is what I like even more is you optimizing for your own life goals and dreams. Refinancing is not an end to itself, it's a tool. It's a tool to get out of debt faster so that you can live the life you want to live. If the life you want to live would be really hemmed in by the amount of payments you'd have to make to pay your loans back, and optimizing for loan forgiveness gives you more freedom, then that's what we want to do. We want you to be able to have a family when you want to have a family. We want you to have a job in a new city when you want to move there. We want you to have the commute that you want to have, not the commute that gets you an extra $10,000 of loan forgiveness a year, because it's probably not even needed. And in some cases, it's just not even that helpful. I mean, just another example, we have people that get bonus payments for PSLF, and it's taxable income, so it's basically like wasted money all around. I'll give you a little bit of an update at the end of the show about that. There's a new update for that for people that get lump sums from employers. Is someone like Susie Orman or Dave Ramsey the person you're optimizing for? I mean, in my opinion, they focus on your typical average person that often will have $10,000 of credit card debt and a middle-class income and maybe $20,000-$30,000 of student loan debt. And you get these sort of student loan porn kind of levels of debt that people call in to shows with. This is fighting the battle with the weapons from the last war. Are you an average person in America with $300,000 of student loan debt with an income that's 50% higher than what the median family in America earns? Median family, not just income earner, like median household. Median household earns around, I think, $50,000 a year. If you're making $80,000, you're making a lot more than the typical family does in America. So you are a special case. And if you have an especially large amount of debt because of our screwed up system, don't blame yourself. If you want to wage war against the debt, you do need to figure out if you need to pay it back or go for forgiveness. But consider all the weapons at your disposal, not just the bayonet. So here's some of the weapons that exist. There's AGI reduction by reducing your 401k, by reducing your income through a 401k. There's the double debt loophole, where if two spouses have wildly different debt to income ratios, you're able to pay a lot less than you would otherwise pay. There's amending tax returns. There's filing taxes separately. There's capped payments, where if you're on pay or IBR, you'll pay a capped amount of money versus unlimited on repay. There's interest subsidies that exist on something like repay. There's the treatment of simple interest on student loans that people frequently send me emails on and say, I found an error in your calculator. The growth in the interest is going to be a lot more than that. And I respond with, you don't understand how the interest works in student loans. It's simple interest, not compounded, as long as you're on an income-driven plan. PSLF, that's a great weapon. That's like the bazooka of student loan weapons. There's the breadwinner and reverse breadwinner loopholes if you live in community property states. There's consolidation. There's targeted consolidation where you can fix only a couple loans without eliminating credit you have on the rest. There's $5 forbearance payments where you can use that to switch repayment plans instead of paying thousands of dollars. There's times where you'll capitalize interest on purpose, and there's times where you'll change your repayment plans. There's the double consolidation weapon that you can fight back against Parent Plus loans with. There's the die with your debt loophole, where if as long as you can live on Social Security, which is the Social Security loophole we call it, as long as you can save enough to live for a few years between the date you retire and the maximum Social Security benefit, you can essentially live on $40,000 a year without paying a dime on student loans if you're getting to that point where you're old and you have student loans. There's the double degree loophole, where if you've failed with trying to find a job that you like and you feel like you need to go back to school to do something you'd like to do more, then the actual solution is you should go back because your payment will still be 10% of your income regardless. There's the insolvency loophole, where if your assets are less than your debt's forgiven tax-free. And then there's the expat loophole, where if you're just like, screw it, and I want to leave the country right now and go live in Australia and do work for a veterinary practice under the table, then you can claim a $0 income in the US and pay nothing in your student loans. And there's more weapons besides that. So just consider that when you're thinking, oh my gosh, I have no choice but to pay down my loans. That's like the people in World War I that were sent into battle with bayonets at machine guns. The debt is way worse than it was back in the day. And people's experience with debt is way different, and they would never have been able to accomplish what they accomplished back then as easily. So you have to use all the weapons at your disposal, and you can sort of choose your own, and that's perfectly valid, especially if you do a lot of reading and try to understand a lot of this and listen to a lot of our podcast episodes, or you could hire an expert that will show you which weapons to use, so to speak. And that's what we do. That's why people hire us for student loan consults. That's why close to 5,000 people have done that. That's all we do is student loan debt. We don't try to sell you, I don't know, some other thing that we don't know about. That's what we know more about than basically anybody else in the world is student loan debt. And so that's why we are so helpful with it, is because we can show you how to do that surgical strike on your student loans, or at least make sure that you're not missing anything, so that when you do go into battle with your student loans, you've at least considered all of the risks and all of the issues that might pop up. So a couple questions before we end the show today. So there's a question about lump sum payments counting now for PSLF. The answer is yes, they do. So this has just changed. I'm going to read this from the Federal Student Aid website. The question is if I pay more than my scheduled monthly student loan payment, can I get PSLF sooner than 10 years? They say, no, you have to make the 120 monthly obligations, but you may prepay or make lump sum payments, which would apply to future months for up to 12 months when your next income-driven payment plan is due. So in other words, it's saying that you would not necessarily get 12 months of credit if that lump sum payment was timed in the middle of the year, right? Maybe you'd only get 6 months if it dropped to that point. But basically, they calculate what you owe. Let's say it's $1,200 a month or something. I'll say $1,000 a month. That math's easier. And so they say it's $1,000 a month, and your employer makes a lump sum contribution of $12,000 on your loans. Well, it used to be that you were screwed, and that was taxable income. It didn't help you at all, and you'd ask them to not even give you the money. Now, if you're going for PSLF, that $12,000 would actually be counting towards your 12 months of payments, and you wouldn't actually have to make payments for 12 months. Like anything, I'm suspicious of Fed Loan actually implementing this. So if you were to use this, then I would submit the PSLF certification form probably two or three times in that year just to make sure that they're actually giving you credit after that lump sum payment was made. It kind of implies that you could do the same thing with IDR plans in general, although they don't state that specifically. And then there's one more question, the employer student loan tax break. So the employer student loan tax break, this is something in the CARES Act that expires at the end of the year. If you don't have it set up already, you're not going to be able to get it set up in time. But employers this year can give $5,250 to you tax-free on both your behalf and their behalf towards student loans. This would have to go on box 14 of your W-2 because it'd have to be listed outside of your taxable wages. The problem with this is this has to be a qualifying employer assistance or education assistance program. What does that mean? It means your employer has to basically have a generic sense of rules that's set up for the plan that says this is how you can utilize it. And then basically you have to not favor highly compensated employees. You can't favor owners. And so it's really restricted as to really how useful it really is. But just know that if you did get money for your student loans this year, just it was worth talking to your HR and just seeing if they'll be willing to list $5,250 as a student loan benefit on box 14 of your W-2. If they do, then that's just tax-free money, and you saved a couple thousand dollars in taxes listening to today's podcast to the very end. So if you need a plan for your student loans, obviously we'd love to help you. The beginning of the year is often a busy time for us. So if you need to get a plan, try to reserve a spot now. You can always change it later. You can go to studentloanplanner.com/book to schedule your plan with one of our consultants. And then again, if you want to refinance your loans, amazing, amazing time to do so. There's super low rates. I think that when everyone starts buying cruises and, you know, international trips again, we might see some serious inflation, which would mean interest rates would go up pretty rapidly. So if you have private loans, definitely apply studentloanplanner.com/refi. If you have federal loans, I would wait until maybe a month or so before the interest expiring, which right now is the end of January. I think that President Biden might extend it to like anywhere between the end of March and the end of September of 2021. So let's get some clarity around that with his maybe executive order or his action when he becomes president January 20th before refinancing federal loans. But for private loans, you really need to take advantage of these bonuses. We've negotiated up higher bonuses than ever before, which is just really cool because I'm excited just because, I mean, we make less money when we have to give bonuses to readers, but that's kind of the point. Student Loan Planner exists to help you, not just to help me, because then I would just be like, what, I guess I'd be a university president or something, right? Ha ha ha. Thank you for listening, everyone, and have a wonderful rest of your week.